I don't know about you, but I am sick of this election. Hey, podcast listeners, it's Anne here, and I'm tired of the candidates and the ads and the arguing, and frankly, the fact that at the end of this whole process, I'm going to be left to make a choice between two people, neither of whom I'm all that crazy about, and the only thing I'm going to get to do is vote yes or no. That just seems stupid. This is the 21st century. Shouldn't there be a better way to make a collective decision about the nation's future? Because the way we do elections right now, it's like every 4 years, we ask everyone in the country to go into a voting booth and decide what we all get to eat for 4 years. Burgers or kale smoothies?
The problem with voting is when I go, say, to a restaurant and I pick a meal off the menu, I'm basically only deciding for myself. And if I make a bad choice, I harm myself. If I make a good choice, I help myself. But when it comes to voting, though, we're deciding for everybody. We're deciding for felons, for immigrants, for non-residents, even people in the other countries that are affected by our decisions, for our children. And the decisions are often very high stakes. We're deciding matters of peace and war, prosperity and poverty. We're picking matters of justice.
This is Jason Brannon. He's a philosopher at Georgetown University, and what bugs him about elections is other voters. Because Jason thinks the problem with elections, the real problem, is that most of us suck at voting. His solution is don't let them, or don't let us, or don't let some of us. He lays out his argument in a new book called Against Democracy. The title alone raised a bunch of questions for Steve Paulson.
Jason, pretty much everyone assumes that democracy is the best possible kind of government, sort of the only kind of government anyone would aspire to. What makes you think that is not true?
Well, it's clear that compared to the alternatives that we've tried, democracy has done pretty well. The best places to live right now are in general liberal democracies rather than one-party states or dictatorships or sham democracies. But that doesn't mean that it's the end of history. And it's worth taking a moment to think about what kind of value does democracy have? So my view is that democracy is just a hammer, nothing more. And if we can find a better hammer, we should use it. And there are some systematic defects with democracy, some systematic problems that it's not clear we can eradicate. Levels of knowledge are very low. The average voter in the United States knows who the president is and pretty much nothing else. They can't really identify who their congresspeople are. They don't know much about ideology. They don't know the basic facts that might be relevant to the election. And non-voters, the people who stay home, they know even less. And the reason for that isn't because people are stupid. It's not because they don't care about justice. It's rather because their votes are a very weak instrument.
You've just put a whole bunch of ideas on the table here. So let's break these down. One is you say that we should consider democracy a hammer. In other words, it doesn't matter about if people feel good during the process. What matters is the result. I mean, is it actually giving us the best form of government we can have? Why is that the only question that matters?
Well, it's clear that most people disagree with that. So I think we're using the right to vote in the U.S. and in other Western democracies as a signal that we consider you a full and equal member of society, and we withhold it from people when we want to insult them. So we take it away from felons, we take it away from children, we used to take it away from women and from minorities. It's true that it happens to be imbued with all this symbolic value, but maybe we should just get rid of that. Maybe we should stop thinking that
way. But maybe that symbolic value is meaningful. And I have to tell you, I'm a very loyal voter, and I feel good when I go voting. And, you know, I, of course, recognize that chances are my individual vote is not really going to amount to a hill of beans. I still feel good about that process, and I feel good about the sense that I'm enfranchised by doing that.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable, too, and I feel good when I vote. You know, I'm not here to say that all voters should feel like what they're doing is worthless, but another way to think of it is just what I'm worried about is that we elevate voting and we tend to denigrate other forms of being a citizen. So despite having what's in some ways an elitist view of what voting is all about, I have a very populist view of civic virtue. I think that the average auto mechanic does a lot more for society by fixing cars than I do by voting.
So you're saying there's no evidence that, say, voting or getting involved in the political process empowers people?
Well, what do we mean by empowerment here? So one way of experimenting with this is to look at people who immigrate to countries where there's compulsory voting regimes, and we can sort of see what happens to their psychology and their sense of themselves. And it doesn't appear that they become more invested in the country. It doesn't appear that they gain more knowledge. It doesn't appear that they care more about participating. And actually, There's even evidence that in compulsory voting regimes where you're forcing everyone to vote, people tend to think, well, I guess the system's more legitimate because more people participate, but they also feel like they have less power because they recognize mathematically that the more people that are voting, the less power they individually have.
Now, that's sort of a fascinating argument because, I mean, there are a lot of people who wish there was compulsory voting in the United States, that everyone, you know, would have to vote, like, for instance, the system in Australia where there is compulsory voting. Yeah, you're saying there's nothing inherently better about the Australian system.
Yeah, I think, you know, Australia overall, I think, has better government than the U.S. But there are also a lot of compulsory voting regimes that have much worse voting government than the U.S. And it's clear that it doesn't seem to really do much. It does get more people to the polls, though in reality, only about 81% of eligible Australians vote. But a hard number of people that are allowed to vote just never register and they get away with it. So they do have high turnout, but it's not clear it does anything else. It doesn't appear to change the kinds of policies that get implemented in any really dramatic way. I do have a worry, though, which is that, like, in the United States, the people who choose to vote are systematically much better informed than the people who tend to stay home. So in the U.S., compulsory voting would be like waving a magic wand that would force ignorant voters to vote more, and that might not be what you want to have happen.
Now, you said that actually a lot of the people who do vote are quite ignorant about politics. What's the evidence for that?
Yeah, so this is probably the best finding or the most systematically supported finding in political science. So back in the 50s, a number of political scientists started studying voter behavior and asking them questions about what they know. And when they do these studies, they actually look at thousands and thousands of people who in fact vote, and they'll ask them questions about what's going on. And the finding is something like this. If you were to divide everyone up who participates into, say, knowledge quartiles, the top 25%, the next 25%, the next 25%, and the bottom, what you'd find is that on this basic quiz of political knowledge that they're given, the top quartile gets like an A-. The next two quartiles do basically no better or worse than chance. It's as if they were voting randomly. And the bottom quartile actually gets the answer systematically wrong. So if you take like in the 1990s, you ask people, you know, who's more conservative, Bob Dole or Bill Clinton? And you find that the bottom 25% of voters like get that question wrong. And this is scary because these are the voters. These are the people who actually participate. And when we look at the non-voters, the ones who stay home, they're even worse on average. They're skewed even more towards ignorant or misinformed.
So you're saying that those ignorant voters, that's your word, they shouldn't be allowed to vote, right?
Well, I think it's worth thinking about alternatives to just straight democratic voting where we give everybody an equal right to vote regardless of their background knowledge. And maybe to kind of soften people up on this, think about the following. Why don't we allow 8-year-olds to vote? So I have a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old, and they're not legally allowed to vote. Why don't we let them? So two reasons people might give. One is that they think they're under the influence of their parents. But the other thing people will say is, well, those kids don't know anything. Why should they vote? They're ignorant. They can vote later when they know something, but they don't know anything right now. But the problem is once you say something like that, you can actually go out and look and find out how much information does the average 14-year-old have? How ignorant are they about politics? And the truth is they are very ignorant on average. But then compare them to the average voter in the U.S., and you don't really see much of a difference. So there's a kind of instability in the common sense view that most people have, where they want to deny the right to vote to children on the grounds that they're ignorant, and yet at the same time give adults the right to vote, even though the adults aren't really much better.
Of course, the problem is, historically, this is a really fraught question because there were certain groups that were excluded. I mean, for a long time, African Americans weren't allowed to vote. Women were not allowed to vote. And then later on, even once African Americans were given the vote, at least in the South, they had to pass certain tests to prove that they were competent. And it was outright racist, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And part of the reason for this, I think, is because we view the right to vote as a sort of badge of honor, a badge of equality. In the past, when we were more racist, when we were more sexist, when we were more sort of pro-Protestant and anti-Catholic and so on, we used this as a way of signaling to people that we regard them as inferior. But if I think about the type of tests that they were giving blacks in the South, I might say my problem with that isn't inherently that they're giving people a test. It's that they're only giving it to some people and they're letting other people like get a right to vote who wouldn't pass that test. So what if instead you had a system in which, take the American National Citizenship Exam, which asks some very basic questions about U.S. history and some very basic questions about just the facts of the matter of how the government works.
This is the test that immigrants have to pass in order to become U.S. citizens.
Yeah, that's right. It turns out, we know because there have been studies on this, most Americans could not pass that test. If you gave it to them right now, they would fail it. Only a small percentage of Americans would pass it. It also turns out that your ability to answer those questions changes what kinds of policies you support. So an interesting finding is that even when you control for the effects of race, of income, of sex, of employment status, and other kinds of demographic factors that can impact what policies you support, even controlling for that, high information and low information voters have systematically different preferences about policy. So for example, in both the Democratic and the Republican Party, high information voters tend to be supportive of free trade, supportive of abortion rights, supportive of higher status for immigrants and easier access for immigrants, criminal justice reform. And these positions don't really correspond to either the Democratic or the Republican platforms, by the way. But that's what high information people on both sides think. Low information people, it turns out empirically, have systematically the opposite preferences.
So you want a system where basically only the high information voters are allowed to vote, right?
Well, there's a number of different ways of doing this. So the technical term for this kind, any of these sorts of systems, was dubbed by a philosopher named David Esland at Brown University. It's called epistocracy. So that comes from the Greek word episteme, meaning knowledge, and krasi, meaning like rule of or power of.
So this is the rule of the knowledgeable.
Yeah, that's right. So in a democracy, every citizen has equal voting rights sort of by law. In an epistocracy, in one way or another, citizens can acquire more power in virtue of knowing more. So one way of doing that is to give everyone a right to vote, but if people have certain credentials or if they pass a quiz, they might acquire an additional right to vote. So this is a system that the economist John Stuart Mill advocated in the 1800s. Another way would be by default, no one has any right to vote, but if you pass a quiz, you can acquire a right to vote. Another system that's been advocated by a Mexican philosopher named Claudio Lopez Guerra is what's called the enfranchisement lottery, where by default, no one has any right to vote. And then right before the election, you select about 20,000 citizens at random, and they and only they acquire the right to vote, but only if they first go through some very basic competence building exercise. Another system would be one in which all laws are passed through democratic legislation, but you have bands of experts that have the legal authority to veto bad legislation in much the same way that the Supreme Court can veto legislation. And maybe if they veto it, it can be overridden, but it would require a supermajority. So you might imagine that the Council of Economic Advisers could veto bad laws, and then the U.S. Congress could override that, but only if they get, say, a two-thirds majority. And finally, a system which sounds kind of convoluted, but I really like the idea of it, is what I call government by simulated oracle. And in a system like that, what happens is everyone gets to vote. But when you vote, you take a quiz of basic knowledge, you write down your demographic information, and then you write down your policy preferences, or you vote for a candidate or something like that. But then instead of just taking what the people actually support, you use that information to statistically determine what would happen to the American public if they could score 100% on that quiz. So in fact, they'll probably score like a 30% on average. But if I magically were to ramp up their knowledge to 100%, what would they support? And if you have those three bits of information and you have, you know, 20,000 people voting, and really hundreds of thousands or millions of people voting in the real world, you can then determine, and anyone who's taken statistics could determine, what would the people support if they were knowledgeable? And the idea here is you do that rather than the thing they in fact support.
But I don't see, I mean, given all of these systems that you, or most of the systems that you've just proposed, I don't see how you get away from the inherent problem of an epistocracy, that it would seem to favor people with more education, higher incomes. In our society, people who are mostly white, aren't these going to be the people who basically end up ruling the country?
Yeah, that's right. So at least one system, the government by simulated oracle and also the enfranchisement lottery, those are designed in a way that can overcome that problem sort of inherently. But the other systems will be ones that will have that issue. It might not be quite as bad as we think. So one is to think of it as a comparison thing. In the U.S. right now, despite it being democratic, it still is the case that high income, high IQ, employed, richer people, privileged people run things. So even thinking about, you know, the worry about high income voters or privileged people voting, it's worth noting a couple interesting features about democracy. So one is, voters don't vote selfishly. We tend to think we do. Everyone believes that he or she votes for what they perceive as justice, but everyone else is a jerk voting for their pocketbooks. When political scientists study this, they find that voters vote altruistically. They vote for what they perceive to be the common good of their nation. So people tend to vote altruistically, and that's true of both parties. It's true of pretty much every ideology. The question is whether they measure up in terms of cognition.
Now, it seems that the devil is in the details here. And so, I mean, in terms of this question of political competency, who gets to set those standards of knowledge? I mean, I can't imagine constructing a test to sort of, you know, determine whether someone is up to speed or not that all sides would agree to. I mean, there are huge controversies, for instance, about what gets into school textbooks about how to teach U.S. history, and the stakes here would be so much higher, and I would think so much more controversial in terms of which questions and answers get put into these competency tests.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I don't think there's any really way to avoid that, to be honest. One way to get around that is to make it fairly basic and just require knowledge of particular facts, just what's the unemployment rate, what's happened to the economy in the past year, can you name your current congressperson, can you name how many people are on the Supreme Court, just very, very basic things.
Well, why do some of the, like, what's the unemployment rate? Why do I need to know that to be able to vote? I don't see why that should determine anything.
Well, think about the recent Brexit vote as an illustration of this. So you can think about what facts would be relevant to Brexit. Something like, how many immigrants are there in the UK? How much money is going back and forth between the UK and the rest of the EU? And here's an interesting finding. So they ask all the voters in the UK, how many immigrants are there? What percentage of the UK is made up of immigrants? The people who voted leave estimated that it was something like 40%. And the people who voted stay estimated that it was something like 20%. And the truth was about 10%. And then they asked them, how much money, what percent of foreign investment is coming from China and what percent of foreign investment is coming from the EU? The people who voted leave, they thought that something like 30% of all investment was coming from China and they were getting less than 1% from the EU. The people who voted stay, they had higher numbers for the EU and lower numbers for China. And the truth was less than 1% was coming from China and 50% was coming from the EU. So you look at the basic facts that might be relevant to the election, what's happening to the economy, how much money is being spent on this. And if people have those facts wrong, they're going to make mistakes about what we should do.
So in the Brexit case, you're saying that those ignorant people who just got everything totally wrong, they should not have been allowed to vote, and the Brexit vote would not have been approved.
If we did have a system in which, suppose your knowledge of the relevant facts were in some way empowered you, it was conditional upon your knowledge of the relevant facts, then yeah, they would have voted stay. And even afterwards, you can see regret from the voters, because after the Brexit was decided, a lot of these facts were published and people started studying them, and they're like, wow, I guess I didn't understand how many immigrants there were, and I didn't really understand what the economic value of trade with the EU is.
So you've presented various alternatives to democracy. I mean, sort of this rule of the knowledgeable that you are calling for. Is any of this happening anywhere in the world? I mean, do we have any case studies of successes here?
No, not really. But, you know, there are things that we could do that are legal, I think, that would get us closer to being an epistocratic system. So suppose you had a rule, and many people who consider themselves ardent Democrats, pro-democracy, are okay with this rule. We change the voting age, and you're allowed to vote only, say, between the ages of 30 and 50. So really old people and really young people can't vote.
You can get drafted and sent off to war at 18, but you can't vote till you're 30.
Yeah. Well, I oppose the draft too, by the way. So let's get rid of that while we're at it. So if you had just that rule, that would make the American voting populace much better informed, because that's the age group at which people have the highest information. Really young people and really old people tend to be very low information. Middle-aged people have higher degrees of information. That, I think, is probably consistent with the 14th Amendment, whereas some of the stuff that we're talking about would require a radical change in the Constitution. It wouldn't be constitutional.
Boy, I'd like to see some politician float that idea that you're going to restrict voting on the basis of this kind of narrow age range.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely wouldn't fly right now. I mean, and the reason for it, I think, is that, like, I like to say that the Nazis gave Jews a Star of David and made them wear it outside as a badge of dishonor, as a public way of signaling, you are inferior, you are not one of us, you don't count. And here in the U.S., we use the vote, the right to vote, as the exact opposite. We give it to people as a way of signaling publicly, we think you count, we think you matter. This is our way of affirming that you're an equal member of our society. So then the question really is a philosophical question. is it written into the fabric of the universe that the right to vote has to mean that? Or is it just this contingent fact about our culture that we happen to treat the right to vote that way? And if it's the latter, if it's just a contingent fact about our culture that we happen to treat the right to vote as having all this symbolic value, then we can start asking, is it a good way of using that symbolism?
You're saying we need to strip the powerful symbolism of how meaningful voting is, and then once we do that, people won't feel like, oh, you know, they're better people or more valued people if they vote, and some will stay home if they don't really care about the political process, and the smart people will end up voting.
Hopefully, yeah. And think about, like, other rules that are kind of like this. Like, I lack the right to practice plumbing in the United States. I'm not allowed to be a plumber. No one thinks that plumbing licensing laws strip us of our dignity. Nobody says, even like the most radical libertarians who hate this stuff, don't say, well, because I'm not allowed to practice plumbing, that shows that I'm not a full and equal member of society. And I feel like I can't show my face in public. And I feel that everyone is saying I'm a second class member. We could treat the right to vote like a plumbing license. We could have no more emotional investment in it than we do with plumbing licenses. I personally don't think anything more of it. So it seems like it's just a contingent fact about our culture that we treat the right to vote with all this symbolic value.
It sounds like, I mean, partly what you're trying to do here is you're trying to say, okay, it's not exactly clear if there's a better system, but let's take a really hard look at democracy because it's not as great as everyone thinks it is.
Yeah, that's right. I say in the book, I don't know for sure that epistocracy would work better. So I'm trying to convince people of a few things. One is, don't think of democracy as inherently just. Instead, just think of it as having the value that a hammer has. And to get to that conclusion, I have to go through a bunch of philosophical arguments that try to get you to the other side. But then once I get you there, I'm trying to say, look, we don't really know if epistocracy would work better. In the same way, if you were writing in the late 1700s and you said we should have democracy instead of monarchy, you didn't really have good support for that. You had some theoretical kinds of claims. You had some sort of mathematical arguments. But at the same time, like when you look around in, say, the late 1700s, you have two sort of democracies, the U.S. And France was a disaster, and the U.S. wasn't obviously any better off than it had been under British monarchical rule. So later, after we actually experiment with democracy, it becomes clear that overall it works better than the alternatives. So I think something like that's going with epistocracy. We can look at problems with democracy. We can theorize about how epistocracy might improve upon it. But we would never know for sure unless we actually experimented with it in the real world.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thanks for listening.
Jason Brannon is a philosopher at the McDonough School of Business at Georgetown University. He was talking with Steve Paulson about his book, Against Democracy. Jason's not the only one who thinks it's time to reimagine democracy. For the next 4 weeks, we'll be doing a series of interviews on alternatives to the electoral system. You can find them and share them in our podcast stream. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.